So I wonder how many of you were here last time when I taught the introduction to Exodus? How many were here? Yes, yes, a few. Okay, and here's the follow-up question. How many of you kept your Exodus outline and have it here today? Double points. Anybody? Nobody? One. Thank you. My hat is off to you if I were wearing a hat. So what I want to do today is I assumed maybe you wouldn't have brought those. So I want to recreate that today, just as a means of getting us into the book. And then I brought for you poor man's lamination tape and scissors so you can cut them and put this into your Bible and keep this so that when we go to Exodus, you can pull it out and look at it. But this shouldn't take too long, okay? So pull out that piece of paper you got on your chair. And does anyone need pens? Everyone, anyone? All right, if you'll pass a few down this way. Anyone else over here need some pens? A few? The few? The unprepared?
I'm still looking for my
pen. Okay, just in case. All right, here you go. All right, and Stephanie has assisted us wonderfully. So this is much better than it was last time. All right, so what I want you to do is to work with me to reproduce our outline here, okay? So if you'll create three blocks on your piece of paper, and at the top we'll call it Exodus. All right? And in the top left here, we need an exit sign. So I want you to draw a big sign here. E-X-I-T. Exit. All right? And the title for our first section is, guess what? What? I can't spell it. Exit from Egypt. Exit from Egypt. All right? That's pretty easy. Everyone with me so far? And you got your persecution, plagues, and pilgrimage. Nice alliteration. All right. Are you guys ready to move on to second column here? Yes, no? Yes? Okay, the second one is the wilderness. Wilderness journey. Now, unfortunately, I forgot to place a space up top here, so this all should have been shifted down. But the graphic that you want up here is a meandering road. So I'm going to draw it down here. Just a meandering path. All right? Wilderness journey. I don't do art projects very often. It's kind of hard to tell how far you are in the process. All right. The final column is Sinai Covenant. And for that, we're going to draw a little covenant here. All right, an X marks the spot where you sign your name. Sinai Covenant. All right, how's everybody doing? Not well? Not done, okay, I'll give you a couple more minutes. All right, does anyone want to use the poor man's lamination? Anyone want to? No? All right. I'll leave it in the back in case anybody wants to. All right, any questions? Everyone doing good?
Chris?
Uh-huh.
I would like to take a picture. I don't have a hard copy Bible, I'd like to take a picture of that on my phone, and I will have it in my photo.
Sure. Go ahead. Good. That's so millennial of you. We like to take pictures of everything.
I'm ahead of my time.
There you go. All right, 30 more seconds. All right, I think we're doing pretty good. All right, everybody done? Everybody ready to move on? I see yeses, yeses, yeses. The noes didn't say anything. All right. Too bad. We're going on. Okay, so let's go ahead and jump into chapter 1. And given our diagram, what would you expect chapter 1 would be about? Yeah, that was a good easy answer. Persecution. All right, so let's go ahead and do this. I want to go around and let's read Exodus chapter 1. The left side of the room is a little more done than the right side. So what we're going to do is take two verses apiece and let's just read it. Starting with Exodus chapter 1, verse 1, I'll start. And then we'll go over to the wall here. All right, so these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. I think I did more than two verses. Wow, that was a lot. Okay, next.
The descendants of Jacob number 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them.
All right.
How many am I reading?
Just two.
And a new king.
Approximately.
Joseph met nothing came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us.
All right, next.
Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh.
All right. Verse 12.
But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and work them ruthlessly.
All right. 13.
They made their lives bitter with harsh labor and brick and mortar and with all the kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Zipporah and Puah,
when you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on a delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live.
Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive.
So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own.
And Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much. So let's jump right into this. I told you last time that there was a word in the Hebrew Bible. They don't use the word Exodus. Do you remember what the title of the book is for them? Do you remember what it is?
Like the Hebrew?
What the Hebrew title for the book is. Names. Yes. The title of this book is Names. Names are very important in the book of Exodus. Keep an eye on the characters in the book that are named and the ones that aren't named. I'm going to point that out to you as we go along, okay? This is a story of redemption. That is the main theme of Exodus, is God redeeming his people. Now, we've had a lot of studying the book of Genesis. What was the book of Genesis about? Do you remember? If there were one word that would summarize Genesis, what would Austin say that is? I see gears moving. Generations, that's a big theme of how the book is set up.
Worship
is a part of the book.
Promise.
Yes, that's very close to it. The theme of Genesis is blessing. It's the blessing of God that went to Abraham, but then Abraham died. And the question is the blessing of God dead? But we saw the blessing transition to Isaac. And Isaac is a blessed man in spite of all the mistakes he makes. But he dies. And then Jacob comes along. And Jacob is blessed, amazingly. Even though he's a weird dude and he does some weird things, he's still blessed. But then what happens as a result of Jacob's death? Israel spreads from that small family of 12, approximately, into 70. And that's where the book of Exodus picks up. It says, these are the names of the sons of Israel that came to Egypt, each with his household. All right, good. Verse 5 says this, all the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, and Joseph was already in Egypt. All right, so you've got this blessed family that comes into Egypt. All right, and look at the next verse. It says, then Joseph died, and all his brothers and that generation. Do you feel the question? What's the question on the reader's mind at this point? What happens next? Is the blessing dead? All of these people that were blessed by God, that generation is gone. Does the blessing carry on? That's right. Yeah, it was tied to the land. And so they're outside of the land. Kevin talked about that this morning. In Ruth, they're in Moab. And the question is, how is the blessing of the Lord going to apply then? But look at verse 7. Do you see the contrast there? But the people of Israel were fruitful and they increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. So you see, Joseph is gone. This protector of Israel, this almost a king. He was a right-hand man to the Pharaoh. Very powerful man. He's gone. The family's gone. But what does the text tell us is happening to this people? What's going on with them? They're being blessed. They're increasing. They're multiplying. And that's part of the Lord's blessing on the people of Israel. You see, the blessing transfers from this family, and you see in verse 7, this family is becoming a nation, and that blessing is transferring to the nation. So this is a special people. All right, but then verse 8 comes up, and I've been thinking about this for the past couple weeks. You get something new in Exodus. In verse 8, we're introduced to an enemy of the people of God. Up to this point, I don't know a specific person in the story that's specifically trying to persecute the people of God, that specifically wants to eliminate them, that wants to do away with them. But see, when you stand against a blessed people, you also stand against the God who's blessing them. And so we're going to find out in this story what happens when people stand against the plan of God to bless his people. So let's take a look at that. Verse 8. Oh, before I go on, any questions you had or thoughts you had about the intro? Anything you want to say? Yes, sir.
Just a principle that I've been thinking and working on a little bit, and it's gone on throughout history. And the further people get from the truth, the more they hate the truth, and the more they try to control the truth, and they see the truth as evil. The truth people say they're wrong, but the evil people will see them as evil.
Mm.
And it seems it's happened through history, and history is his story, and I see it right here.
And their perspective becomes warped. In fact, Pharaoh is going to say, the text is going to say, Pharaoh acts shrewdly. Now, that's kind of an interesting concept, but as a reader, we're invited to say, does Pharaoh really act shrewdly? Shrewd is another word for wisely. Does he really act with wisdom?
In whose eyes?
In whose eyes? Is it? That's what we're going to ask and answer this morning. Any other thoughts before we move on? Yes, sir.
I just thought about it. That's the first time I've heard Exodus is, you know, makes sense, right? Naming all these people and all these generations. I just remember growing up in the temple that chosen people, that term is used common. A lot of Jews mean that to be like, well, I'm Jewish, I'm saved, I don't need to worry about heaven, or definitely don't need to worry about Jesus. I'm saved, God likes me. You walk a very tightrope when, okay, so everything's based on the name and your blood, like you're not in that family, you can't be part of that. Leads you down a path of, so what about the other 98% of the people in the world?
Yep.
And I asked my dad, I'm like, well, okay, the chosen people, what were you chosen to do? And he comes up with some answer about making life better and stuff like that. I'm like, well, if you read the Bible, it seems pretty clear that the seed was chosen from the very beginning to go through these people, through this tribe, to get to the Messiah of the world. And that's what was chosen, biblically speaking.
Yeah.
And when you get away from the truth and get away from analyzing it, you're like, well, let's just make things better and treat people nicely. Okay, hey, you do that stuff too.
Yeah.
But why are you doing it?
Yeah, there's a purpose. I agree with you, and we're going to get to this covenant part, hopefully eventually, I don't know, 10 years later, I don't know. At the pace we're going, might never ever get to it. But a covenant implies mutual obligations. And there's obligations on God's part, but there's also obligations on the people's part. And being the people of God means something. It requires something from us and from them. All right, any other thoughts?
I'm just interested to think about when it was that this pharaoh came up that didn't know Joseph. Like, Joseph was alive for a long time into their time in Egypt, and then he died, and there would have been people alive who knew him. And then suddenly someone comes up and didn't. Was it like right after the person who was with him died, or is it like 300 or 100 years in, 150, 200, I don't know.
And would they not know the history?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read, like, recently in a book that I had to read for seminary that during this time there was, like, the Egyptian pharaohs, but then there were also these people called the Epiru, which many people confuse with the Hebrews, who also kind of warred over for that. And so we saw, like, a whole line of people actually kind of taking over Egypt, and that's why they didn't really know much of the history, because they weren't really associated with the Jews here like the people in Egypt were. And so when Egypt finally wrests control back, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, we don't know who this Joseph person is because they've been separated from them for so long in the sense of their history.
Yeah, that's a very valid way to read the text. I'm not an Egyptologist, and I do study Old Testament, but Egyptology doesn't really interest me. So I'm not going to go into a lot of that history of the pharaohs and things like that. There are other people that could probably do that a little better. But that's a very valid explanation for why they might not know. I have another alternative that I'm going to offer, but that's on my next note. And I think you had a question.
Well, you made the comment about the term shrewdly, and Exodus 1:10, which is where shrewdly is mentioned, and it's actually the Pharaoh talking. So the shrewdly thing seems to be from his viewpoint. It's not necessarily from general.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, so the Pharaoh says, let us act shrewdly. And I probably didn't say it clearly. What I meant was the narrator is saying, let's listen in on this situation and let's see if he really is as shrewd as he claims to be. That was what I was meaning. Yes, sir.
I think it's interesting what Pharaoh says. I mean, there's, and what he does, actually, because in verse 10 it says, you know, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become more numerous, which makes it sound like he's concerned about them overpowering them. But then at the end of verse 10, it says, if war breaks out, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So why, I mean, it's like, if he's also concerned about them leaving, and yet he's also concerned about them staying and becoming too numerous. So it's almost like there's a little bit of a contradiction.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have a clear game plan, does he? Like, what's going on?
If he's concerned about them becoming, you know, overpowering them, you would think he would be okay with them leaving and just going somewhere else, but he doesn't seem, you know, he's worried about that.
No, and in the story, he doesn't want them to go. And, you know, he
needs a slight labor force.
That's right, he wants the labor force.
Based on that, so,
yeah. Yeah. So, the next verse says, let's see, where was I? Verse 8. I think, there arose a new king who did not know Joseph. Now, the word know is really, really important in this book. And so I want to give you a preview of something that we're going to talk about later. This comes from the JPS commentary, which is doesn't mean anything to you, but my point is this is a Jewish commentary on the book of Exodus. So if someone were to know what the Jewish word know means, it's probably them. They'd probably be intimately aware of the language, okay? And this is what they say about the word know. This is the first appearance in Exodus of the Hebrew word yada, meaning to know. It's a key term in the Exodus narrative, and it occurs over 20 times in the first 14 chapters. The usual rendering of the word hardly does justice to its range. And here's the important part. In a biblical conception, knowledge is not essentially or primarily rooted in the intellect or a mental activity. Rather, it's a more experiential and embedded in the emotions so that it may encompass qualities such as contact, intimacy, concern, relatedness, mutuality. Conversely, not to know is synonymous with disassociation, indifference, alienation, and estrangement. It culminates in a callous disregard for another's humanity. I think that's an interesting way to deal with this concept of know. I really think, and hopefully I'll be able to prove this to you later on as this word know comes up, that they're not just talking about someone not recognizing the name of Joseph, although that is a possibility. I think what they're talking about here is he's saying, I don't recognize this Joseph. What does he have to do with me? He's not around anymore. I don't care about his people. It's this idea of distance. Okay? Yes.
I don't acknowledge you.
That's right. Yeah. And that might apply to some Old Testament proverbs that you're probably aware of. In all your ways, acknowledge the Lord, and he will direct your paths. A lot of times when we hear these intellectual words, we assume they're only up here. But the Jewish people don't separate these two, and the Old Testament doesn't separate this from this. I don't think that'll translate into the... Okay.
Yeah, like the book I was saying, that like even though the people like who came back and wrested control and stuff, it wasn't that they weren't aware of the history or like the Israelites. It was more that they're like, what does that mean to us?
Yeah.
Or like they don't know the connection between Joseph and like, you know, his importance to Egypt.
That's right. Yeah, what does it matter to me? That would be a synonym. All right. So... deal shrewdly. We already touched on this. The narrator is inviting the readers to consider, is the king of Egypt actually being as wise as he claimed? All right, notice also, let me pull your attention to this. Who's named so far in the story? From verse 8 to verse 22, who's named? Take a look.
Joseph's the only one with the
name. Joseph is named so far. The king of Egypt isn't named. Who else is or is not named?
Children of Jacob.
Say again?
Jacob's children, the tribes.
Yep. Yep. The tribes of Israel are named because those are important to the story.
The midwives.
The Hebrew midwives are named. He doesn't even name the most important, powerful man in the day, the king of Egypt, but he names these two unimportant people. These two people that have an average everyday job, just doing their own thing. He names the two of them. Interesting. All right. So what's his plan? He says in verse 10, come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies. Therefore, we're going to set taskmasters over them. In verse 12, I love this. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. Amazingly, I think that's the story of the Jewish people throughout time. That the more they've been oppressed, the more God has preserved and blessed them as a people. All right. And the Egyptians were in dread. So here's, they're supposed to be dealing wisely with this people, okay? They were in dread, so they ruthlessly made the people work as slaves, verse 13, and made their lives bitter. All right, now the king of Egypt in verse 15, he's a little worried. His plan has not worked out well so far. He's been trying to deal shrewdly with them so that they don't multiply, but They've been multiplying. They're everywhere. So plan has failed so far. So here's step two of the plan, okay? He asks these midwives, one of whose name was Shipra and the other one Puah. Those names might mean something. I'm not aware of the etymology of those names. I apologize. I assume they mean something. But these are characters that are important to the narrative. Hence, he gives their names. When you serve as a midwife and you see on the birth stool a son, kill him. If it's a daughter, let it live. Okay, so what's his grand plan at this point? He's going to ask a person whose job it is to preserve life, to take life. That's his plan at this point. And how does that work out? Not so well, right? Yeah. Yeah. You're like, you really think they're going to kill their own people? Come on. But, you know, he's wise, apparently. You know, he's a wise guy, and that's his plan. But here's what I love. It's the simple act of doing what they're supposed to do. Simple obedience. And by that act, the midwives are able to thwart the machinations of the most powerful man of the most powerful nation in that day. Isn't that powerful? I love that. Okay, so I think we're going to have to deal with this, aren't we? The lie, right? I asked you guys last time to fill out some cards about questions you have about the book of Exodus, and the lie was part of that. So let's take a look at the narrative here. In verse 17 it says, "But the midwives feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live." Okay, not a problem. That's good. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said, "Why have you done this and let the male children live?" The midwives said, "The Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwives come to them." So how have you dealt with this? They're told to do something evil, but they don't do it, okay? And then God blesses them. So first off, my first question is, do they lie? Yes or no? And then how have you dealt with this?
How was midwife, at that point, were midwives living, I don't know, third trimester, is the midwife like living in the home? Is this a lie? I don't know, do they live in the neighborhood, and next village over, like, oh, I don't know. What was the life of a midwife at that point? Were they actually?
I don't know that we know.
Was it a lie?
I don't know. I've asked that question myself, too.
But it says specifically that they let the boys live.
Mm-hmm.
But there are multiple ways that could happen. They could let them live by not going and being there.
It's like asking your five-year-old to come, you know, and they're dragging their feet. Okay, I'm coming. Is that what happened?
But also, they say the Hebrew women are more vigorous. Well, of course they are, because they're slaves. They're working hard. Yeah. These are strong women. The Egyptian women would be
pampered.
There would be a difference.
So it is conceivable that they didn't lie.
Yeah.
It's conceivable. Okay, how else have you dealt with this?
Well, you think about war, right? Let's say somebody's a spy. He's going to be lying to be a spy, right? Lying to the enemy. Okay, and then there's a soldier over here who's shooting the enemy. Well, if it's okay to shoot an enemy, is it not okay to lie to the same enemy?
Yeah.
So any time in the Bible where I see a lie that is somehow excused, there's some kind of official conflict taking place.
Well,
and that's kind of how I interpret this.
Mm-hmm.
Either preserve life or the blessing.
Yeah.
Lies may have to occur.
Okay.
I kind of deal with it like, look at the situation through God's eyes. And, Rahab lied about the spies, you know, and they're doing God's will in a greater thing. And like maybe I stole from my employer $100, and I said, no, I didn't steal $100. Well, what in God's eye would be the right thing to do there? Hmm. I'm just trying to save my butt, you know? And God says, you don't need to be saved, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, if you have a greater good in God's eye, that you can be justified in breaking a lesser law.
That's okay. All right.
And maybe also the heart of the person involved, whereas Rahab and the midwives were... I just think about the contrast with Abram when he lied, kind of taking over, not trusting God to protect him. So he was kind of like, okay, I'm going to handle this, versus Rahab and the midwives were doing it with a different...
Mm-hmm. There's a different intent, different attitude.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Kind of go along the lines of what you're saying. God even uses Pharaoh for his story.
Mm.
Like, he gives Pharaoh a chance to turn, and Pharaoh's adamant, you know, his heart is hardened. And so he can use bad for good, and that's what he's doing here.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I can't wrap my mind around that.
I kind of see, like, all throughout the Bible, whenever, like, the seed is brought up or God's anointed, like, they seem to have... almost like different rules in a way, like, because you see stuff with David and other people doing things that, you know, normally you shouldn't be allowed to do, or they're being protected, and people, and the anointed, God's anointed can make punishments, they can judge people, whereas, you know, that's God's role, they're acting as like a mediator, you know, but God put them in that position. So I kind of see it as like, this is the chosen seed getting to these people, so it's like anything to protect them, I feel is justifiable. So maybe not, like, you know, anything for the greater good, because that really depends on God's commandment to you or what he says to you specifically, because then we could really misinterpret that. But I think anything that's protecting the seed at this point is justifiable.
I don't plan to offer you a solution to this question. I think there's some things in the Old Testament that we have to wrestle with. They're difficult questions. And I like the way you wrestle with this. It's possible that it wasn't a lie. It's possible that it was. But either way, it's interesting to me that God doesn't correct them. And the story just says that God blesses them because they feared him. I don't know. There seems to be this thing we have to wrestle with. But in some sense, God doesn't seem to be wrestling with this particular issue in this text. In other places, deception is wrestled with. But if this is a deception... He still blesses them. I don't know. One more thought, then we'll move on.
This is something that kind of gets to the heart of what God expects of people, I think, because God talks about his nature where it's against his nature to lie. But what he tells the people to do is right there in the Ten Commandments. It says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. It doesn't say you shall not lie. It says you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. So the command is, this: A, it's about being in a court setting or being in that setting where you have a chance to witness, and it's also against somebody else. So there's a deliberate acting lovingly or unlovingly towards someone, where I think that is what God expects of people in a broken world. I could be wrong about that, but that's a way that I can easily reconcile it to myself.
Okay. I think we ought to be a people of the truth, and we ought to be a people who speak truth, who love, and I think lying ought not to be a part of our daily routine. Okay. That's all. Okay, so I want to offer maybe 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'm going to close. I want to read a quote, and then I want to throw this to you. How do you apply Exodus 1? What from this strikes you as something that you ought to apply in your life? And please don't say lie. So the main point of this is that small people, through small acts, are thwarting the evil from the most powerful men in the world. Does that sound a little like Lord of the Rings to you? Well, my friend, it ought to, okay? I'm going to read you a quote from Gandalf, okay? Gandalf says this: some believe it's only the great power that can hold evil in check. But that's not what I've found. It's the small, everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay, small acts of kindness and love. He said, "Why did I choose Bilbo Baggins? Perhaps because I'm afraid, and he gives me courage." The small acts of small people. All right, how would you apply Exodus chapter 1? We'll do 2 minutes, and then we'll close.
Well, I mean, I think that's true if you consider if God's on their side. Because people do things all the time that are not necessarily going to be effective.
And God is behind these people, very much so. He's blessing this nation.
I think we have to consider what our role is when responding to Jewish people. So specifically here, this is preservation, and I think, you know, even in our recent history, there have been Christians who played a role in preserving God's people. But I think we also have a role in responding to God's chosen people and continuing to reach out in evangelism to them.
That's good.
Well, I'm married to you, so I'm going to have a particular bent on this. But key word that I see is that they feared the Lord. Mm-hmm. And it kind of jumping back to the lying thing, but it doesn't say God blessed them because they lied. It said God blessed them because they feared the Lord. And so I think to me that's something that's still deeply applicable, that if we fear the Lord, he will bless us.
I'm doing my thesis on fear of the Lord, so I'm going to try not to sideline every chapter into the fear of the Lord, okay? So,
I did it for you.
Thank you. You can bring it up. One more and then we'll close.
I think that even in, you know, a really bad situation, because this was a horrible situation for the Israelites, but God was still in that situation, still working his will through it, still weaving his way through history. And that doesn't mean everything's going to turn out the way we would want it to, or well the way we would want it to, because I'm sure there were Israelites that suffered and didn't make it through that time period. But overall, God was still working his plan, moving his people forward and delivering them from the evil and the persecution that was there. So he kept his purpose and he kept his direction throughout all of it.
And that's so beautiful. In chapter 2, the end of chapter 2 is one, I think, my favorite of the whole book of Exodus. And it talks about this persecution that the people are feeling and experiencing, and they're saying, where are you, God? And the narrator gives us a peek into what God is thinking and feeling and about to do. And I think that's the most beautiful part of Exodus chapter 2, but that's for next time.